Paper 1, Section 5, Old Single Column, page 27. Okay, as I'm sure you remember, it took us all group last week to go through that one little section of Section 4. It's going to loosen up in terms of density a little bit tonight. So even though this looks like it's an incredibly long section, it's like, wow, how will we ever even finish this section if we only got the last one done last time? You'll see it's they've constructed this next section purposely to be to be read in larger blocks, absorbed in larger blocks, because they're trying to really make a very definitive appeal to you. So it will go more easily than the last one. But as always, there's all kinds of marvelous precision and challenges that they've woven in, and we'll bring those out. Let's get rolling here.
Personality of the Universal Father. Do not permit the magnitude of God, His infinity, either to obscure or eclipse His personality. He who planned the ear, shall he not hear? He who formed the eye, shall he not see? The Universal Father is the acme of divine personality. He is the origin and destiny of personality throughout all creation. God is both infinite and personal. He is an infinite personality. The Father is truly a personality, notwithstanding that the infinity of His person places Him forever beyond the full comprehension of material and finite beings. God is much more than a personality, as personality is understood by the human mind. He is even far more than any possible concept of a superpersonality. But it is utterly futile to discuss such incomprehensible concepts of divine personality with the minds of material creatures whose maximum concept of the reality of being consists in the idea and ideal of personality. The material creature's highest being, the material creature's highest possible concept of the universal creator is embraced within the spiritual ideals of the exalted idea of divine personality. Therefore, although you may know that God must be much more than the human conception of personality, you equally well know that the Universal Father cannot possibly be anything less than an eternal, infinite, true, good, and beautiful personality.
Okay. Now that last little bit, for those who are very familiar with the Jesus Papers, that should immediately remind you of a passage in the Rodin Papers, in the second Rodin paper. I mean, it's practically spot parallel to that. Affirmation declaration that Rodin gives about this when he finally is convinced that the Father, that God has to be a personality, but, obviously has to be much, much more as well. And, and it's tied to reasoning like they have in those, that little Bible quote in that first paragraph from the Psalms there. Everything has to have a source. If you're going to recognize that you're a personality, there has to be a source of that personality. If there's the concept of sight in the universe, that has to have a source. It's obviously going to be some extremely high transcendent sightedness, but sight can't just come out of nowhere. Everything has to have a source. So that logical recognition that, of course, Rodin was fully capable of making, and that the revelators are constantly challenging us to get into that mode, just use a little bit of that logical acumen, that first cosmic intuition, and just recognize the obvious. The basics are self-evident. And, you know, when you start talking about much more than the human conception of personality, you know, as you can kind of see the way they constructed that, in a sense, they're defining what they're going to mean by personality, by the word personality, just, you know, as that single word. That that's really going to be a specific term tied to the finite. I mean, sometimes you use it in a more general way, but if you're using it specifically, it's really a finite word. If you're going to talk about the absonite, you're going to talk about super personality, you're going to, and beyond that, you have ultra personality and omnipersonality, you know, et cetera. I mean, you're trying to, you know, give some sort of conceptual recognition to the hierarchy of you know, the domains of the of reality, but you know, they're trying to stress that you know, humans are capable of a concept along this line, and let's take the fullest extent of that capability that humans have, and let's call that fullest, you know, supremacy of recognition of personality, personality. Yeah. Or, in other words, the fullest recognition of spirit pattern, spirit purposing. Let's call that personality. Now, notice one little thing they do in there. The material creature's highest possible concept of the universal creator is embraced within the spiritual ideals of the exalted idea of divine personality. Okay, so now, you know, as soon as you see one of your proper designations for a facet of, you know, of the deity of the Father, see if you can directly recognize what they're referring to. You know, when you look at it in the infinite eternal ellipse. Okay, I mean, if you know, they're very much stressing that we're standing in the finite domain. We're looking at this from the finite viewpoint. So, you know, put yourself there. Put yourself in the fifth level domain. Okay, and you're going to, you know, they just emphasize we're talking about an infinite personality. You know, they stress that over and over. Okay, so we're looking towards infinity from the finite viewpoint. We're looking this way around the ellipse. And you know, they brought up universal creator. Okay, so I'm looking, you know, around the circuit of the Father, and there's the universal creator. And just think, you know, precisely about what they're saying there. The highest possible concept. When you're looking from the finite viewpoint, your conceptual sight has horizon lines, you know, that we've indicated on the chart. If you're looking this direction with that direct conceptual sight, this is the horizon line of that sight. You know, in any sort of direct conceptual way, you can't see past that line. You know, in order to go past that line, you're going to need revelation and insight to put it together. See, so, you know, that's all they're saying is, you know, this what we're going to call the universal Father is when you go beyond that, just that creative notion that you're going to give that name, the universal creator, to, that facet of the Father, you go beyond that to your conceptual horizon, and there's the universal Father. Okay? Right there. You know, that self-personalized deity, facet of the Father. So it's, you know, it's just a very direct expression. Just notice what they're trying to do. You know, and you see this, like, well, they're talking about the Father and personality. Why did they even bring up universal creator? Isn't that kind of a non sequitur? That's what they're hoping, you know, that you'll actually say. It's like, well, you know, and if you're a new reader, you know, you're not going to know what to do. But now that we've got, you know, a bit of total deity under our belts, and we can think about this a little more precisely, just follow the clues. You know, put yourself in the finite vantage point. Look towards the universal creator, and what do you see immediately beyond that at the horizon? You see the universal father. Okay? So that's what they're invoking there. So where do they go next?
God is not hiding from any of his creatures. He is unapproachable to so many orders of beings only because he dwells in a light which no material creature can approach. The immensity and grandeur of the divine personality is beyond the grasp of the unperfected mind of evolutionary mortals. He measures the waters in the hollow of his hand, measures a universe with the span of his hand. It is he who sits on the circle of the earth, who stretches out the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a universe to dwell in. Lift up your eyes on high and behold, who has created all these things? Who brings out their worlds by number and calls them all by their names? And so it is true that the invisible things of God are partially understood by the things which are made. Today, and as you are, you must discern the invisible Maker through his manifold and diverse creation, as well as through the revelation and ministration of his sons and their numerous subordinates.
Okay. Now there are the divine counselors just having a grand time tweaking, you know, especially Isaiah. You know, most of that, all the stuff in the middle there is Isaiah. Like I said, we're not going to, you know, analyze every time how they've tweaked the Bible passage, but just note one, just get the spirit of what he's doing here. That when he starts off, measures the waters in the hollow of his hand, measures a universe with the span of his hand. Well, I mean, you're going, well, I know that the Bible is not going to say a universe. You know that's a tweak. And it says heavens, directly in the Bible. And so he's tweaked that. And just notice what he's done. He's sneaking something in. You know, we're talking about the Father and everything, but he doesn't miss the opportunity to sneak in a little an aside here. You know, he could have, instead of saying heavens, he could have said universe of universes or universe. You know, just measures the universe. You know, but he said a universe. In other words, he's pointing to a local universe. So think about that literally. Okay, what's the image that he's invoking there? There's a hand. It spans the entire local universe. Everyone in the local universe stands on that hand, that upholding hand. Who is that hand?
Creative Mother Spirit.
See, so in the midst of talking about the Father, you know, he throws in that little, get you to start thinking, you know, with the precision, not having everything all lumped together. It's all somehow magically done by the Father. Little things like that, you know, thrown in. So, indirectly, if you're really noticing, he's got the word upholder in your head. Okay? You're thinking about the local upholder, you know, the local mother. I don't know, maybe one of them is really funny. The one where, he stretches out the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a universe again to dwell in. Well, that's a big change, you know, instead of a tent, like it says in the Bible. It's a universe. Okay. But see, just see the spirit of what he does. It's like, you know, okay, that's all wonderful as a spiritual descriptor, you know, that passage in Isaiah, but let's have this, you know, the spirit of it and the precision of it. That initial tent that we're all dwelling in is the local universe. So, yeah, that's, you know, he's always doing that. They're always doing that. And like I said, you know, a lot of times you can tell, you know, if there's something, you know, it doesn't say worlds, you know, it says starry hosts and things like that. You know, they're always putting in the factual elements in the place of the fuzzy words, you know, that are in the Bible passage. Let's see here. Every once in a while he can't resist just sort of taking a whole bunch of Bible passages and putting them together in a little tweaked set, you know.
I thought it was interesting how he says, "He who sits on the circle of the earth." Mm-hmm. That's kind of not really.
Yeah, you know, in other words, you know, he who embraces the whole circumference, you know, of the earth. All right, so, you know, and bringing in that little bit of Paul there from Romans at the end, you know, to help motivate the visible, invisible, you know, to begin thinking about that. You know, and if he ends it like that, he's probably going to pick up and continue with that little theme. So let's see where he goes next with that little reflection.
Even though material mortals cannot see the person of God, they should rejoice in the assurance that he is a person. By faith, accept the truth which portrays that the universal Father so loved the world as to provide for the eternal spiritual progression of its lowly inhabitants, that he delights in his children. God is lacking none of those superhuman and divine attributes which constitute a perfect, eternal, loving, and infinite creator personality.
One little thing I want you to get you thinking about, because he's going to build on it. He brings in the word faith. And like we've tried to point out many times, you want a nice little pithy, you know, initial definition of the fact of faith. It's personal recognition. You know, that's what's the title? Personality of the Universal Father. You know, you want to be thinking that, you know, that in recognition about what the word faith means. Personal recognition. By personal recognition, accept the truth, which betrays that the universal Father, who's, you know, the personal face of the Father. And then, fun little playing with John 3:16 there, of course, you know, so loved the world. And again, just, you know, even though he's not sort of quoting there, he didn't put anything in quotes, he's obviously, you know, alluding to John 3:16 and giving it a much more definitive expression, you know. So loved the world as to provide for the eternal spiritual progression of its lowly inhabitants. Even when he's not quoting, he's constantly, you know, using the Bible as a leverage point here. Okay, so keep that in mind, you know, about how we want to really be always thinking, where's this referring to personality? Because that's the purpose of this section. So always be looking for that.
Where's this quote, delights in his children?
Oh, that's in the Old Testament, a few places. They're sort of just taking the spirit of a few quotes in the Old Testament about, you know, delights in his children.
In the local creations, accepting the personnel of the super universes, God has no personal or residential manifestation aside from the Paradise Creator's sons, who are the fathers of the inhabited worlds and the sovereigns of the local universes. If the faith of the creature were perfect, he would assuredly know that when he had seen a Creator's son, he had seen the Universal Father. In seeking for the Father, he would not ask nor expect to see other than the Son. Mortal man simply cannot see God until he achieves completed spirit transformation and actually attains paradise.
Okay, so he's continuing that theme about what you can see and what you can't see. Right away he's bringing it up again. If the faith of the creature were perfect. Now, if you're using some very Sunday school sort of concept of the word faith, you know, where does that take you? You know, if the fervent belief of the creature were perfect, I mean, that, you know, what does that get me? See, if the personal recognition of the creature were perfect, he would assuredly know that when he had seen a creator's son, he had seen the universal father. Okay, so think what they're saying there. You know, they're trying to get you to really challenge your notion of what the word personality means. Okay, so they're saying, if I really had a clear personal recognition, when I observed a creator's son, I would know that what I'm seeing is all that I could possibly see in some character, some nature, if I were looking at the Father. Well, exactly what is that I'm seeing? I mean, perfect's a pretty strong word. Okay, so, I mean, if I have this very clear vision of a creator son, I mean, I know it's a creator son. I know he's like on Salvington. He's not on paradise, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, how could I not know that this is a creator son and not the universal father? You know, I think about all those sorts of things. Oh, well, that all those sorts of things, sort of the immediate things, must not be what personality is about. Personality must be something much subtler, much more transcendent. And we've talked about this a number of times. I mean, you know, the threefold actuality is unity, for instance. You know, you have this threefold actuality in the universe. And what does personality do when it enters into the picture? It's a harmonizing influence on that threefold actuality. You know, so fundamentally, if I'm recognizing personality, I'm recognizing that harmonizing influence, a cosmic harmony that's in play. So think about, you know, rethink this whole comparison between a creator son and the universal father in that light. When you look at the you know, and recognize the measure of harmony that sort of goes beyond what's directly observable, but is just that subtle spiritual essence that you can see is within that creator son, that it has this perfect harmony to it, to the limits of your finite, you know, and I said perfect, if you had a perfect clear view of this, you know, to the limits of that finite view, it is perfect harmony. And you wouldn't, you know, there's no way that if you looked right at the universal father, you could see any greater measure of harmony. So even though, I mean, the personality of the father and the personality of a given creator son is not the exact same personality. I mean, the creator son has a absolutely unique personality, just like you and I. But when you think about it, see, and not in that absolute uniqueness, because again, if you think about it in that way, that's a nonsensical statement. You know? I mean, they're separate personalities. But that harmonizing influence that comes from that person, and that, you know, the harmony that then is inherent within that individual because of that, that's what they're referring to. That's the truth of that statement. You know, you're not literally seeing the Father, but you are seeing as much harmony that comes from personality as you can possibly see until you begin to mature beyond the field of view that is completely spanned by a creator son. Once your field of view, you know, is wider than the width of a creator son, okay, now you're going to be able to see something in addition. But not initially.
You know, he said, he who's seen the Son has seen the Father.
Mm-hmm.
But you could stand in his presence and still not see him. What you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, the truth of that is there's a truth besides just the literalness of it.
Yeah, and you know, and of course you've got them. You know, the way they've back here. You know, if the faith of the creature were perfect, well, when is it going to be? When is it going to be perfect? You know, not for a while. You know, you don't have perfection of purpose, and you know, until you're ready to enter a havona, you know, etc. So, yeah.
Well, that reminds me. It's somewhere in the Ranch book. It says, first you have to love those you can see before you can love those you can't see.
Yeah, yeah, and you know that's the kind of thing they're alluding to here with this visible, invisible, you know, invoking that reflection. And you'll see they bring that up more definitively. You know, when you know that faith is personal recognition, well, you know, he's a personality, she's a personality. It's not just God that's a personality. You know, that word applies to all persons. You know, and you obviously want to start by having personal recognition with the person that's sitting in the room with you, and build up to the infinite personality on paradise. And he obviously is going to continue to build this, but that's the key. All right.
The natures of the paradise creator's sons do not encompass all the unqualified potentials of the universal absoluteness of the infinite nature of the first great source and center. But the universal Father is in every way divinely present in the Creator's sons. The Father and his sons are one. These paradise sons of the Order of Michael are perfect personalities, even the pattern for all local universe personality, from that of the bright and morning star down to the lowest human creature of progressing animal evolution.
Divinely, I'm stressing that. I mean, you know, again, to get you to what I was just saying, you know, what is divine? Divinity is deity likeness. Okay? And that deity likeness, that divinity, that's harmony. Cosmic harmony. And so that's what you're seeing. You know, when you look at the harmony, you know, the divinity, you are seeing the same kind of perfect harmony that you would see if you saw the Father, and to the limits of your sight. You're obviously not literally seeing, like they're saying, all of the, you know, energy, infinity of the Father and what have you. But in terms of that harmony, what really manifests from personality, yes, you are.
Without God, and except for his great and central person, there would be no personality throughout all the vast universe of universes. God is personality. Notwithstanding that God is an eternal power, a majestic presence, a transcendent ideal, and a glorious spirit, though he is all these and infinitely more, nonetheless, he is truly and everlastingly a perfect creator personality, a person who can know and be known, who can love and be loved, and who can befriend us. While you can be known as other humans have been known, as the friend of God, he is a real spirit and a spiritual reality.
Okay, those two little paragraphs, you know, he had a lot of fun using Isaiah's words. Now he's doing the same with the Apostle John. It's like, okay, let's work with the Apostle John a little bit here. So, you know and be known and love and be loved. That's coming from John. And, you know, when you think about John, you know, the Gospel of John and John's first epistle, we all know there's two classic little sentences in there, little one-liners. God is spirit and God is love. Oh, God is personality. See, he's playing on that, you know, in that previous one. See, these two little paragraphs go together. It's like, okay, let's think about what John said, and let's use that as a point of recognition. Not only can we say, like John said, God is spirit and God is love, Well, we could say God is personality. Because, of course, if you don't have a personality, you can't have love. And that's where love comes from, is from personality. You know, so he is a real spirit. God is spirit and a spiritual reality. God is love. You know, in the same order, know and be known. God is spirit. Love and be loved. God is love. So there, you know, he's wanting you to reflect on those two classic lines from John, you know, and bring in personality, you know, and just the way he said those last two things, you know, using the where they often do, you know, taking two words and putting them in both orders. I mean, God is spirit, or a real spirit, you know. There's pattern applied to that spirit. He's a person. And a spiritual reality. He's a personality, a spiritual personality. Just another way you could say those two lines. And again, because he's a personality, he can love. And because he's literally, you know, because spirit is a literal substance, that can be known. You know? So, you know, putting those two together, see, is challenging you to think of spirit as a literal substance too, if you think about it. You know, if spirit is just some fuzzy, wishful thinking word or something, then there's the word known has no place in association with that. But if spirit is a literal substance, yes, you can stub your toe on it, and you can know it experientially. The more you're familiar with the Bible, the more you see what he's doing, you know, and he's just having fun here with Isaiah and John.
You can stub your toe on it only if you have a spirit toe.
Yes, that's true.
Just wanted to clear that.
But we're coming to that. That's part of the story here. So keep on.
As we see the Universal Father revealed throughout his universe, as we discern him indwelling his myriads of creatures, as we behold him in the persons of his sovereign sons, as we continue to sense his divine presence here and there, near and afar, let us not doubt nor question his personality primacy. Notwithstanding all these far-flung distributions, he remains a true person and everlastingly maintains personal connection with the countless hosts of his creatures scattered throughout the universe of universes.
Okay, there's a key word in here that he's wanting you to connect to something that he used earearlier. Remember we said we were expecting to have this lengthy discussion about the Universal Father, and one of the very first things he did is he said the Universal Creator. And we were trying to figure out why he did that. Yeah. Does anyone remember what the little one-line label is for that facet of the Father, the Universal Creator? That's self-distributive deity. All these far-flung distributions. See, this paragraph is taking you back. You know, just because he's this universal creator, this self-distributive deity, you know, and he's divested himself of everything that he can divest himself of. Don't lose sight of the fact that he's still a definitive person. You know, so that's what's going on there. Again, they're getting you to think about the difference between those two facets of the Father, the universal Father and the universal Creator. And, you know, they, you know, we've pointed out this, you know, just be looking for those key words that you've tied something definitive to. You know, the word distributive is definitively tied to that facet of the Father. So when they use that, that's what he's invoking. You know, if you've gotten to the point of deity recognition like that. Okay, so again, he's saying, despite the fact he's the universal creator, he's the universal Father also. Now what?
The idea of the personality of the Universal Father is an enlarged and truer concept of God, which has come to mankind chiefly through revelation. Reason, wisdom, and religious experience all infer and imply the personality of God, but they do not altogether validate it. Even the indwelling thought adjuster is pre-personal. The truth and maturity of any religion is directly proportional to its concept of the infinite personality of God and to its grasp of the absolute unity of deity. The idea of a personal deity becomes, then, the measure of religious maturity after religion has first formulated the concept of the unity of God.
Now that's a biggie. Yeah. It's worth, let me just read that last sentence again. Let that sink in. The idea of a personal deity becomes then the measure of religious maturity after religion has first formulated the concept of the unity of God. What is the unity of God? Deity. Deity. You know, what's the one quality that's attached to that word? Deity. You know, it's unity. You know, and God is personalized deity. So think about what they're saying. Oh, yeah, like we pointed out when we started reading the foreword. The first section in the foreword, is it God? No. Is deity. The second section is God, just like they just said. First, you know, if you're going to have a mature religion, first, you've got to formulate a concept of deity, total deity. And once you've done that, now begin to reflect on the personalization of that deity. On God. I mean, this is a huge statement. I mean, you know, the first thought you might have is, I know a number of so-called religions in the world that have no personal deity notion in them. So those aren't mature. Well, neither is anything else. Okay, just because you have a personal deity, whereas some other so-called religion doesn't mean you have a mature religion. Neither of those are mature, because they just define what a mature religion is. It's one that has a solid recognition of deity and then brings in personality, a recognition of God. See, and that's why we're making such a huge effort now. Now that we've gotten to the point where we've got our hands on some of these aspects of deity and can work with it and talk about it, we're trying to develop a mature religion in our minds by getting a solid recognition of deity, an understanding of deity, and then in that recognition, bringing in the personalization.
You made me think about when Jesus and Gainan were at Alexandria, and it says here, paper 130, section 3,
right. And, you know, we all know that historically the word deity is kind of used, you know, basically like that. It's sort of a synonym for God or a godlike notion, even if it's not really personal, that's in the religion. Another way of thinking about this in terms of historically, you know, the challenge they're putting before you here is, you know that some Eastern religions, for instance, you know, began to get some vague notions of the supreme, the absolute, etc., but no personality. There's a truth in that. Use the revelation to get a solid recognition of deity, just as deity, as defined in the book, not as an alternate name for God. You know, kind of like a lot of those Eastern peoples have been trying to do for millennia, only really do it now because you have revelation and can sort it out instead of getting all muddled like they all did. And now re-engage your monotheism that most likely you were raised in. Now bring in personality in the midst of this much expanded and solid recognition of deity. Yeah, again, you think about the very first thing that they did. They gave you a little preface just to, introduce you. And then the very first thing they do in this book is define deity. Basically, challenge you to want to even have a relationship. I want a book that the first thing it tells talks about is God. And this book doesn't do it. So this book is not doing it for me. I mean, they're basically putting that challenge right there, section one in the book. They're going to challenge you to engage something that's not personality, but infinitely, absolutely transcendent. You know, and then we're going to talk about God, because they want to try to encourage you to a mature, a true religion. You know, we know we've got to get true religion, true philosophy, true science. I mean, true religion is one of the indispensables to advancing civilization, for instance. Yeah, we've got to have that. It's the first indispensable of advancing civilization. All right, so I wanted to really, you know, stress that. I mean, that's a huge challenge that's being laid down. You know, ask yourself as a longtime Urantia book reader, have I done that yet? You know, or do I still have an immature religion? Am I still putting new wine in old wineskins?
Let's assume the latter. Okay, yeah. You know, just to start out with. If you assume the latter, mm-hmm. the question now becomes, okay, the greatest model we have for doing this is Jesus. He didn't have a Urantia book. What he did have was unbroken communion with his paradise Father. And it was through, in an experiential way, that he engaged deity and personalized and had a personal relationship with deity. Mm-hmm. There was a relationship of trust that he had that was just rock solid. Mm-hmm. So we're given, and it's not just intellectual, you know, it's a substrate, it's an intellectual substrate, but we're not to leave it there as intellectual, we're to engage it in the way that Jesus of Nazareth engaged all of his rudimentary first century concepts, and somehow, because of his internal personal religious experience from age 4.5 and right. 4, brought this sense of deity and personality together that way. And just backtracking a little bit, part of what they're referring to, obviously, is the fact that, you know, historically, we came out of polytheism. And one thing that they're referring to is the fact that, well, in polytheism, you have all kinds of personality, but there's no unity in deity whatsoever.
Right.
It all represents all these facets, these psychological facets of how I view God. And I'm being asked to bring that, all those psychological facets together in one whole, and then personalize it.
Right. And the only thing I want to add to that is the recognition of going from the fourth epical revelation to the fifth. That which is of greatest value, you know, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. There's no way to develop cosmic consciousness if you don't first have a spiritual consciousness. If you haven't allowed the spiritual uplifter to uplift you, to do like he demonstrated, an exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with God. He showed us how you can get that actual spiritual character going within you, so that you can have a personal religious experience. You can have religion, you know, in a genuine sense. Now that you have that, now that you've done like Jesus did, now that you've made yourself a God-conscious individual, recognize that you're a God-conscious citizen. And the first thing that you're a citizen of is this world, you know, the nation that you're in. And that's where the fifth epical revelation begins to come in. And that's, you know, where I, you know, where I'm stressing from. If we want to have a true science and a true philosophy anchored in our inner life with a true religion, we have to have more than just what you need to be saved, sort of, you know, to get things going right within. We've got to be able to have a logical consciousness in play that you can transfer to all of these other things of the world. And the best place to start with developing that logical relationship to reality is within. Get a solid logical connection to deity. Now take that, you know, that what you've developed there, that ability to engage that with precision and clarity, and transform science in the same way that you just transformed your inner life with God, so that you don't just have, you know, that faint flicker of faith that recognizes a personal God and is going to be okay. But you've got basically, for an inner life, you have vastly more than you need in this life to just get to the next life. I mean, you don't need total deity just to get to the next life. You know, to respond to Jesus' call to recognize that you're a son of God. You need, you know, to challenge yourself to engage total deity, because you want to do more than that now. You want to be part of an advancing civilization that can't be without that which goes beyond the inner life. You know, it's fundamentally what the fifth epical revelation is here for. Yeah, it's to begin the process of taking what Michael gave us in the fourth epical revelation and doing something with it. One must do something as well as be something. He made it so that we could be. And now the challenge is to do. And they're giving you very fundamental hints like this. The doing this is going to require a mature religion. Only a mature religion can engage this benighted sphere with just, you know, impossibly intractable problems that are all around us. You're going to have something really solid. Not just a recognition of the Universal Father. You're going to need the whole picture. You're going to need a real sense of you know, not that you're being, just that you're being drawn by the spirit gravity, but that your feet are firmly planted, so that when the world assails you, you're ready for it. You can think on your feet. You can engage it. You can be the kind of legislator that the world needs. You won't be caught off guard because you have the big picture in your consciousness. You can do the kind of things that Jesus did in his private ministry, you know, in little vignettes. Only we need to do that openly and globally. All right, so that's the spirit that they're trying to get invoked here. Let's read a little more here.
Primitive religion had many personal gods, and they were fashioned in the image of man. Revelation affirms the validity of the personality concept of God, which is merely possible in the scientific postulate of a first cause, and is only provisionally suggested in the philosophic idea of universal unity. Only by personality approach can a person begin to comprehend the unity of God. To deny the personality of the first source and center leaves one only the choice of two philosophic dilemmas, materialism or pantheism.
Okay, now, you know, you see right there, you know, like Andre was pointing out, I mean, we have, you know, some vague anthropomorphic-like notion of personalized deities, you know, lowercase d, from polytheism. So, you know, that's obviously coming in, you know, is in the mix here, and they acknowledge that. We're going to talk, you know, a lot more, you know, in the next paragraph about materialism and pantheism. But just remind, you know, for those that are a little unclear about that, and by materialism here, we don't mean, you know, you like big screen TVs, you know, more than anything else. Not that kind of materialism. You know, we're talking about the philosophic assumption that there is nothing in the universe except matter. Everything is matter, period. There's no mind, there's no spirit, there's no personality, there's nothing. All there is matter. Okay, that's materialism, the kind of materialism we're talking about. And then pantheism here, you know, we're talking about that notion that's kind of related to materialism, that's kind of coming out of deism, sorts of ideas, where you're saying, okay, God is not a personality. What God is you have this self-existent universe, and that self-existent universe has laws and forces and manifestations in it, and, you know, et cetera, all that stuff, that's God. Those laws, forces, manifestations, et cetera, of this self-existent universe, that's God. That's pantheism that we're talking about here.
Sounds a little bit like
Lou. Yeah, so, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit in the next paragraph more. But the thing I want you to notice, it's tied to what we were just emphasizing in the previous paragraph. Notice what they say here. Only by personality approach can any person begin, you know, any person begin to comprehend the unity of God, deity. So that should motivate you a little bit more. Oh, so in other words, if I actually get to the point where I'm beginning to have a definitive recognition of what they mean by deity and some of the facets of that deity, I'm actually beginning to actualize my personality potential. The only way I can do that is via my personality. Myself can't do that. You know you'd like to have a greater personal relationship with the Universal Father. Well, if you're going to have a greater personal relationship with the Universal Father, you're going to need to have a wider scope of harmony within you. You need a broader actualization of the potential of the personality that God gave you. They're telling you a really great way to do that, to really start to broaden your horizons. Take up the challenge to comprehend deity. That will inexorably actualize your personality, because you can't do it without it. Yeah. So that, you can see what they're trying to do. They're trying to explain why they put deity in section one and God in section two of the foreword. That it's super important. It's not just that D comes before G in the alphabet. Yeah? It's a super, super important thing. If you want to be able to break out of the old wineskins and start to have that relationship with God and that sense of integrity within, that peace that passes all understanding sort of nature that can handle the difficulties of life, how are you going to do that? You're going to take up this very difficult challenge of trying to have more than just a more aggrandized exaltation of monotheism. Monotheism with six other absolutes hanging around doing something or other. Okay? You're gonna go beyond even the expanded individuality viewpoint. You're gonna go beyond the seven absolutes of infinity. You're gonna figure out what the unity viewpoint looks like. See, the unity of God. You can't get it with no matter how much you expand the individuality viewpoint, no matter how many frandalanks you add to the list, you know, they're all part of the God that's sevenfold. It's somehow, you know, that's not what we're looking for. We're not looking for just, you know, memorizing all the individuality and expanding our individuality viewpoint, trying to get a unity viewpoint. And not just, well, I think there's kind of a unity amongst all that individuality. We're not talking about that. We're talking about an actual unity viewpoint. Where things, where you turn it around, instead of having a starting point of the seven absolutes infinity, you turn it around and what's the original? The universal one of infinity. A whole new starting point from the unity viewpoint. And what the heck is that? And what does that mean? You know, and that's, you know, we've gotten to this point. We know because we've sorted through the Supreme Papers. We've followed their clues. The first Supreme Paper, paper 115, doesn't start, okay, now remember the seven absolutes infinity. The first thing they say is, you know how we talked about the seven absolutes infinity? Well, instead of thinking of it like that, let's talk about the original, the actual, and the potential. You remember, that's how they started, you know? Because you can't get to experiential deity from the seven absolutes infinity. You got to have the unity viewpoint in play. And that's why over and over in there they kept saying, if you're going to understand this, yeah, you need some individuality viewpoint, but you have to have the unity viewpoint simultaneously in an equal measure. Because it's the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two that gets you the recognition of this experiential deity that we're talking about. And if all you have is the individuality viewpoint, all you're going to have is the Almighty. All you're going to have is the Supreme Being's body. You're going to have his power pattern part. You're not going to have his personal purposive part. You're not going to understand where that comes from. See, just all this is coming together. I just wanted you to just notice how this, you know, how we've just sort of got ourselves perfectly in sync here, you know, in building up the way we have and beginning to recognize this. As we've rolled back around now, you know, we can see more what they're trying to do here right from the beginning that we haven't recognized before. You know, this whole bit of really getting deity, you know, up front in our thinking. And that's why he's been throwing in that other facet of the Father, that other facet of the deity, the universal creator. And, you know, from the unity viewpoint, the universal Father is not an individual. That's one of the facets of the deity of the Father, you know, et cetera. Okay, so now see, well, what he does.
In the contemplation of deity, the concept of personality must be divested of the idea of corporeality. A material body is not indispensable to personality in either man or God. The corporeality error is shown in both extremes of human philosophy. In materialism, since man loses his body at death, he ceases to exist as a personality. In pantheism, since God has no body, he is not therefore a person. The superhuman type of progressing personality functions in a union of mind and spirit.
Okay. So just, you know, now you appreciate a little bit more why he brought up materialism and pantheism, so he could, you know, get you to, use that kind of dichotomy, sort of, you know, to reflect on personality a little bit more. And pantheism is really not the biggie point that's going on here. The materialism is really the key thing to spend some time reflecting on. And again, remind yourself, we're not talking about, you know, sort of the common, you know, well, he's really materialistic, i.e. he loves money, you know, and blah, blah, blah. We're talking about philosophic materialism. And remind yourself now really soberly how you've, from the moment you're born on this planet now, you're steeped in this. For, you know, a good 150 years now or so, intellectual mankind is just steeped in materialism. It's oozed into your pores all over the place, okay? in ways that you've never stopped to recognize. And they're trying to get you to stop and recognize this. There are a lot, not just of people and religionists in the world, but a lot of Urantia book readers, longtime Urantia book readers, who have an old wineskin in this regard that needs to be recognized. If you, you know, think about this materialism assumption. You know, if what personality is tied to matter, okay, what's that saying? That's saying that this thing that we've always called personality, you know, since the dawn of time, what that is the expression of genetic, you know, structure. It's genetically expressed temperament. It's temperament. Materialism is the main reason, because it's just kind of, you know, an unquestioned assumption in so much of human consciousness now. That's why humans have been steadily, even humans who want to have a personal relationship with God and everything, have unwittingly begun to drift into this mode where they think of the word personality as temperament, genetic temperament. And they observe, you know, the temperament of an individual, and they talk about it, how that's, you know, different facets of personality or different personality types and stuff like this. It has nothing to do with personality in the way we're trying to reestablish it. That's temperament. And to think that that temperament is personality is materialism. You know, you're being a materialist with that thought. You know, in the midst of being sometimes a wild-eyed mystic spiritist, you're actually a materialist when you think that. That's the point they're trying to make. It's like, recognize that. And you go, I don't want to be a materialist. You should immediately go, whoa, I am never going to do that again. I am never, ever going to think that temperament is personality. What I'm going to think is, that has to be the antithesis of personality, basically. I mean, I want to look in 180 degrees in the other direction to figure out what this thing personality that they're talking about is. If it's nothing else, it's not that. Yeah. You know it's not that. You may not know what it is, but you know it's not that. That's about matter.
You know, well, what about Jesus? They say, you know, then he said he came back. Well, you know, he who has seen me has seen the Father. And then they're going to go to the next point. Remember, he got angry when he cast out the... So I'm going to check out that scripture where, you know, and see what I can see in there and see if I can manipulate that some way to show, you know, see what's in the text, see if it's possible to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe he didn't get angry in this situation, you know?
Well, and notice how you're bringing that up. It's like, oh yeah, and they did mention all of the many personal gods, and you know, they're how extremely fashioned in the image of man, how anthropomorphic they were, you know. And so, you know, humans have personality, like they're prone to fits of rage. You know, therefore, God, you know, has a personality like that too. See, and as I say, you know, and you go, well, that's just old, you know, primitive people thinking like that. No, we've just got, all we've done, we're still just as primitive in modern times. You know, but now we have a fancy word for it, philosophical materialism, and positivism. And, you know, we don't believe in fairy tales anymore. If I can't stub my toe on it, you know, and I can only stub my toe on this stuff, you know, it doesn't exist. And therefore, you know, if there's a God... It all has to be rooted in matter and humans' material temperaments and, you know, tying that to certain genes and on we go.
So you got a God gene.
Yeah, yeah.
It's making God in man's image.
Sure, I mean, right. I mean, it's, you know, it just, no matter how sophisticated we've gotten, we have all these elaborate theologies and stuff, you know, they're trying to point out, that's why the first thing they said to really invoke this is they're invoking, you know, that very primitive notion of polytheism. It's like, guys, you aren't any different. You just think you're fancier now. Huh? And the real problem is that those of you who are actually trying to get a greater relationship with the personal God that your faint flicker of faith has recognized, but have gotten frustrated after decades, and it seems like you're not really making much progress. You're still struggling with the same things you were struggling with 50 years ago. Why? See, they're trying to help you to recognize you've got this boat anchor that's attached to you, this material boat anchor, this materialism that you haven't recognized. You know, stop trying to somehow understand your temperament and tune your temperament, and then you'll be tuned to God. Your temperament can't be tuned to God. Only your personality can be tuned to God. Notice how our thoughts are going here. I mean, the challenge is immediate. That, okay, I'm immediately thinking about all the things that personality isn't, and how many people I know that don't get it, etc. Notice how immediately the tendency is to go to a negative engagement of yourself and the world around you. That's why the Revelators do what they do in the next paragraph. Okay? Because the solution to this, is not to beat yourself up and go, it's like, oh, I've been so blind all these years. Why have I been doing this? You know, forget about it. Just let all that be. Take up this new challenge to have this whole new positive, upwardly directed search for the truth of personality that replaces, your old life. You know, that's what they're challenging. Look at what they say next here.
Personality is not simply an attribute of God. It rather stands for the totality of the coordinated infinite nature and the unified divine will, which is exhibited in eternity and universality of perfect expression. Personality, in the supreme sense, is the revelation of God to the universe of universes.
Okay, notice how they set that off, see, by big spaces on both sides. They're not even going to let you, it's not simply an attribute of God. You know, it's no part of God. You know personality is not a thing in any sense of the word thing. In terms of this kind of things, or even spirit substance things, or whatever. And look at, they just take it all the way, use as big a words as they can to stress its transcendence. Rather, it stands for the totality of the coordinated infinite nature and the unified divine will. Those of us who've been developing a recognition of deity and the key words are attached to certain facets of this, coordinated. Okay? That's a mother word. We all know that's a mother word. What are they invoking here? The specifics of what they're invoking are beyond the scope of what we do here on Friday nights, like I've said a few times here recently. But the basics of what they're invoking there is, remember how when we recognized, that fundamentally you can give names to God the Mother at the various levels in the vertical hierarchy, expanding on that word upholder. For the totality of the finite, you have the finite upholder. For the fullness of the absentite, you have the absentite upholder, etc. Well, you take that ever higher expression of the mother, the deity of the mother, all the way up to the infinite level, you get to the infinite upholder. And we've talked about how what happens there, that's at the, at the infinite level, the father is the mother. Or more precisely, the words father and mother no longer really have direct meaning. You've transcended that. In a fairly definitive way, at the absolute level, you can talk about the father and the mother, but really technically, when you go up to the infinite level, it's just like, you know, when you go behind the eternal sun and the Isle of Paradise, you know, to the first source and center, you've transcended spirit and matter. And those words really don't have, you know, literal meaning anymore in any definitive way, because it's prior to the differentiation into spirit and matter. Same thing here. When you go all the way up to the infinite upholder, okay, there is a mother likeness in the Father there. I mean, technically, this unified, I mean, that's also related to the upholder. The nature of the Father is unified in infiniteness. You know, they use the word coordinated infinite nature. The nature of the Father is unified in infiniteness by the infinite upholder. That's technically what's behind their statement there. And that you have, the reason that you can have this infinite expression of personality likeness, of harmony, is because of that action of the infinite upholder unifying the picture and giving it this perfectly harmonious whole. You know, it's not six disjoint parts. It's not the first center is laying there and the first source is laying there. There's the universal Father, there's the universal Creator, there's the universal Controller, and there's the infinite upholder over there in the corner. You know, the infinite upholder has unified it all in infiniteness. Is this coordinated personality, harmonious expression. That's the personality of the Father. Coming from that self-mother relationship in the Father. Yep.
One of the key insights of the Orange Book is that thing which unifies all else, in which everything else becomes a descriptor of, if you will, is the personality of God. That is, in fact, primal. That's of all of these ways of looking at God, that's at the center. And it enables you then to stand back and start to get in context, you know, the fact God is all of these things, but how do all of these things fit together? You know, we know God is one, but still, I got to, you know, how is it? And this is a way of prioritizing them for us so that we can actually help. That's where I can build my concept of the unity of God to the degree that it's not experiential, right? I mean, I have an experience of God, but my idea of God, you know, where do I start? And I think that's very much what's going on.
Very much. And how that applies to you, that last, you know, that personality is a revelation of God to the universe of universes. In the same way you were just describing about the unity that is God comes from that personality bringing it all together. Also up in the forward, they told you, well, you have a body and you have mind. And you're encircuited in the spirit, plus you've got a spirit fragment in you. And you've got some moronchous substance. You have a soul. But what brings that all together? What transcends all that and can bring it all together into a whole? Personality. So if you do like God did, bring it all together, coordinate it all, then you have God-likeness. You have actualized your personality. You know, and like when we do the selfhood personality, you know, thing up through the levels of meaning. You know, what's beyond selflessness in the fifth level of meaning? Godlikeness. Selfhood to personality. You know, it's a, you know, you become a revelation of a measure of the harmony of God if you transcend selflessness. Because what lies beyond that is God-likeness and actual manifestation of personality, this thing that we're actually calling personality. Because what's that sixth level of meaning? That's the spiritual level. What's personality? It's spirit pattern. Until you get up to the sixth level, you can't pattern spirit, because spirit's not in play yet. There's no place, there's nothing for personality to do yet. There's lots of stuff for temperament to do, welling up from the bottom. But until you get up to the top there, you can't bring in the personality in any definitive way. You got to get up to the spiritual level. Okay? And like I said, we aren't going to go into the deity, the extreme top-down viewpoint that brings this into play, and just how transcendent we're talking about here. But between the lines are invoking the infinite upholder facet of the Father here to understand the unified and the coordinated words, why they're in that sentence. If you start at the top with the Trinity infinite and come down, the first thing that you grab is the infinite upholder. What did this within God that they're talking about? There isn't anything higher. So no matter how you look at it, the recognition of the threefold actuality, now there can only be that harmonized unity likeness, if personality comes into play, because that's the only thing that can transcend the differential between those three things. It's the only thing that comes from above those three things. What's above the aisle and the conjoint actor and the eternal Son? What's above the absolute of matter, the absolute mind and the absolute spirit? First source and center, source of personality. So no matter how you look at it, the merit's point is exactly what you're supposed to recognize. There isn't anything higher than personality, okay? Or how personality, did what it did to make God what he is. There isn't anything higher than that process. It's all at the highest of highs. And so it is so far removed from what we often use the word personality for. They're trying to get you to recognize that. See? All right. Okay. So we, in between the lines, they invoke the infinite upholder. Now what do they do next?
God, being eternal, universal, absolute, and infinite, does not grow in knowledge nor increase in wisdom. God does not acquire experience, as finite man might conjecture or comprehend, but he does, within the realms of his own eternal personality, enjoy those continuous expansions of self-realization which are in certain ways comparable to and analogous with the acquirement of new experience by the finite creatures of the evolutionary worlds.
Okay. What's the deity in this paragraph? Okay. God does not acquire experience as finite man might conjecture or comprehend. Yes, definitely. Because of all the facets of the Father, the one where the word experience comes in is the infinite upholder, self-experiential deity. Not experiential deity, self-experiential deity. As finite man might conjecture or comprehend, that's transcendent of anything. I mean, you can go all the way up to the absolute with existential experiential deity, and still beyond that is what we're talking about. It's beyond our comprehension in any direct way. This thing that we're calling self-experiential deity, the infinite upholder. Okay? However, how can I begin to understand how God does engage me as an evolutionary experiential creature? Again, there's a key word. He does enjoy those continuous expansions of self-realization. There's a facet of the deity of the Father that has that key word in it. Okay? The universal controller is self-expansive deity. And we'll read the next paragraph before we follow that up. But that's what they're invoking. So we've had to see that the universal creator has been in play, the infinite upholder. They just brought in the universal controller. And of course, we have the universal father. You know, they said that you should try to comprehend the unity of God, all the facets of the deity of the Father. They've got them sprinkled all over in here for you to begin thinking about and how they all fit come into play here, how they fit together. Okay, Susan, read that next one.
The absolute perfection of the infinite God would cause him to suffer the awful limitations of unqualified finality of perfectedness, were it not a fact that the universal Father directly participates in the personality struggle of every imperfect soul in the wide universe who seeks by divine aid to ascend to the spiritually perfect worlds on high. This progressive experience of every spirit being and every mortal creature throughout the universe of universes is a part of the Father's ever-expanding deity consciousness of the never-ending divine circle of ceaseless self-realization.
A circle, like the infinite eternal ellipse. Okay, so let's put these two together. Okay, in that previous one, that continuous expansions, the self-expanding deity, continuous expansions of self-realization. And then they say how this, is in certain ways comparable to and analogous with the acquirement of new experience by the finite creatures of the evolutionary worlds. It's like, okay, so I'm a finite creature of the evolutionary worlds. I'm an evolutionary experiential being. Okay? So I say, okay, I've got the functional levels of total deity. One of those levels is the evolutional level. The fifth level. Or when we put it in the ellipse, the fifth level domain. Okay? So, I mean, that's what we're talking about. That's where I am. That's where God is engaging me directly. As, you know, at the evolutional level, because I'm an evolutionary creature. Okay? So, in there with me, he says it says that there's something about the Father that does have a relationship to that. It's in certain ways comparable to and analogous with what's going on there. Okay, it must be somehow in that level and synchronized with it in some way. Yeah, what's there? The universal controller, the self-expansive deity, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about the universal controller. Okay? And how, see, you as a, you know, very much an animal origin, material-minded, you know, mortal self right now, mostly matter. There's a potential for spirit identity, but it's mostly matter right now. How is the Father directly syncing up with you as the universal controller? And then in the context of him synchronizing with you with that facet of himself, the universal controller, in that context, he can engage you as the universal Father. And this personal thing can happen that we're talking about. But you're so far removed from something like the eternal Son that the universal Father engages directly. Okay, it can't happen just via the universal Father to engage you. It takes two facets of the Father. The universal controller is what's directly syncing up. And then in that synchronization, the universal Father can connect to you. Okay, what facet of deity is actually engaging you? Creature identified deity. What facet of deity is that? That's the sevenfold. The sevenfold has the sevenfold creators and the sevenfold controllers. The Father's at the top of those two as the universal controller and the universal Father. That's what we're talking about here, precisely how that happens. The universal controller is what directly is there with you in the evolutional level, that functional level, the evolutionality of deity, and is directly engaging you. And engaging you as a material thing with this personality superimposed upon it at the highest level of superimposition, in that context, then the universal Father can engage you as that person. That's why there isn't just the sevenfold creators. That's why creature-identified deity has these two tracks, parallel tracks. It takes both of those to engage you. Yeah. That's what they're bringing. It's all in there between the lines, see? When you just all start picking up on this just handful of key words, coordinated and, you know, and distributive and expansive. They have just a handful of key words, and they use them very precisely. So that when you're ready to start comprehending the unity of God, it's all right here to start putting it together. And then in this context of having a universal creator and an infinite upholder and a universal controller, in the midst of all that, there's the universal Father, that self-personalized facet of deity in the Father. All right, how about the last paragraph?
It is literally true. In all your afflictions, he is afflicted. In all your triumphs, he triumphs in and with you. His prepersonal divine spirit is a real part of you. The Isle of Paradise responds to all the physical metamorphoses of the universe of universes. The eternal sun includes all the spirit impulses of all creation. The conjoint actor encompasses all the mind expression of the expanding cosmos. The universal Father realizes in the fullness of the divine consciousness all the individual experience of the progressive struggles of the expanding minds and the ascending spirits of every entity, being, and personality of the whole evolutionary creation of time and space. And this is literally true, for in him we all live and move and have our being.
See how they're putting it all together and using a bunch of Bible quotes too. I mean, but, you know, again, expanding minds. You know, what can synchronize with those expanding material minds? Self-expansive deity. You know, and in that context, the universal Father realizes the fullness of divine consciousness. Just what we were just saying. You know, and yeah, it is not the case that down at the finite level that directly, literally, in him we live and move and have our being. We talked about that up in the Supreme Papers. They invoked that and said, well, now technically, that's the Supreme. You know, in whom you live and move and have your being. But there is, you know, around the finite is the absonite. Around the absonite is the co-absolute. Around the co-absolute is the co-infinite. And around it all is the infinite upholder. I mean, it all is within the womb of the infinite upholder, to the extent to which you can even use that word now, because you've really gone beyond mother and father. But, you know, all is held in the infinite upholding of the infinite upholder. In him we live and move and have our being.
Is not the infinite upholder invoked in the Old Testament quite a lot?
Sure.
You know, and they just put it all under the term capital L-O-R-D, you know, well, and, the unnamed.
You know, you have universal creator and all these sorts of, you know.
The richness of some of that text is just, you know, it's just all there. It's just, but it's in a very brutal environment, so a lot of people shy away from it.
And even if a specific reference to the infinite upholder or the universal creator, if you look at the specificity of the reference, it's like, well, not quite. But still, you know, the relatives are saying, you know, what did they needed a name for that facet of the Father. They could have just coined one, but they looked at all the names we had. Well, they've got this name, Infinite Upholder. You know, that works perfectly. We're going to use that. The revelatory mandate, you know, says that we must use that. You know, unless it goes beyond more distortion of meaning. You know, and so again, just like he was showing us with John, and especially with Isaiah there, real close, Isaiah, just change these couple of things, and now we've got something that I can put in paper one of the fifth epical revelation. All it takes is a little tweaking, you know, of the label Ancient of Days and turn it into Ancients of Days, or the Infinite Upholder, you know, etc. And you can use those as a, you know, as the launching point from your current evolutional, evolutionary, I guess I should say, you know, relationship to God and deity, and go right into, you know, I get what they're talking about here. I see how what humans had there, or what I had there, had the spirit of truth in it a little bit, you know, and I can just pull that out and I can put it in nice solid clarity, you know, in the picture of total deity, and now I've really got an amazing new relationship to God. I see God as engaging me with all of this amazing orchestration, you know, that, you know, he made me so far removed from him, but there's a part of him that can still grab me directly, the universal controller. And once that hand has me, the other hands can get me. So wow, it's actually a whole different way of thinking about matter. And that tendency to really demonize, you know, matter and call it materialism, only, you know, that's actually where he's engaging you most directly. I mean, every automaton in my body, you know, is spherical about the point presence of the aisle. And what's directly behind and engaging the aisle? Which hand of the Father? Which facet of the Father? The universal controller. I mean, is that not getting down inside of you pretty intimately? The universal controller comes through that point presence of the aisle at the center of every automaton in your body and grabs you. How much more do you want the Father to grab you?
Upper hand
anymore? Yeah. I mean, it doesn't get any more intimate than that, you know? And so if he holds you rock solid like the aisle at the core of every one of your automatons, how perfectly can that subtle personality engagement of the Universal Father engage you? You know, he can hold you infinitely still if you'll just let him. And then it can engage you. You know, let him do that. Let the universal controller hold you, you know, so that you can reach that high, down-reaching hand of the universal Father, that personal hand that you so desperately desire. You know, again, you know, in the next thing, they'll start bringing up the three cosmic intuitions, you know, and reminding you what I was just saying there. You can't just do it with the spiritual insight. You have to have the logical acumen as well. That grounds you in the hand of the universal controller. If you haven't taken delight in cultivating your first cosmic intuition, you can't get grounded in the Father. You know, and so you're shaking about in the subtle hand coming from the infinite level of the universal Father's personality engagement. Just can't synchronize. Okay? Yeah, where are you? Okay, you know, you have to take the light in cultivating all three, you know, cosmic relationship with all three cosmic intuitions. Yeah, and then you're something that spans the wholeness of that which is trying to engage you, the sevenfold. All right, so we'll pick that up then next time. You know, like we've pointed out, the paper finishes out, you know, with the personality picture. And like Merritt was saying, I mean, that's obviously the main point of the first of the five you know, this first Pentateuch on the Father, on God the Father, is the personal part comes first, the universal Father. And we'll talk about more of the the other aspects, you know, after that. But, all right, so let's take a little moment and reflect on that.